This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. How much is too much to spend on a high school football stadium? The answer to that question is different in each community that asks it, and the answer is bigger in Texas, where everything's bigger and football is king. Last week, voters in McKinney, Texas, 37 miles north of Dallas, approved building what some say will be, at least temporarily, the most expensive high school football stadium in the country. McKinney is next door to the previous holder of that somewhat dubious title, Allen, Texas, and that's where Only a Game's Karen Given begins our story.
I visited Allen back in 2010 as site preparation was just beginning on the new Eagles Stadium. And it's true, I went looking for controversy. The internet had been abuzz for months over the stadium's $60 million price tag. People were asking questions like, why does a high school need 18,000 seats? And what's the deal with that 38-foot-wide high-def video screen? As it turns out, those people were in places like New York. They were here in Boston. They weren't in Allen, Texas, at least not as far as I could tell.
She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy.
I attended the last home game of the 2010 season. It was on the Friday before Halloween. Every senior and all 550 members of the marching band were in costume. Two guys dressed as the Seuss characters, Thing One and Thing Two, were singing Journey songs during breaks in the action. Allen was still playing in a 14,000-seat stadium, and the place was full. I walked up and down the aisles looking for anyone who thought the new 18,000-seat stadium would be too expensive or maybe too big. Instead, I found Rob Morton. He told me that he was actually worried that the new stadium would be too small. Besides,
there was a vote. We all voted for it. There was no controversy whatsoever. Everybody, it wasn't a close vote. And so I think everyone kind of needs to settle down about that. We're going to build it and we'll sell it out.
Sitting not too far away, sisters Zena Bender and Deborah Del Reyes didn't see what the fuss was all about.
No. Anything for our kids. We want them to have the best, always. I'll pay the higher taxes for that. Not a problem.
I know. I don't even like football, and I'm here every week. I get excited.
Anything for our kids. I heard that phrase over and over. And the voters in Allen weren't just talking about the kids who play football. On my visit to the school, I saw the studio where students produced the daily announcements in the style of a TV morning news show. The equipment looked newer and more sophisticated than the studio at the university I had attended. But a new studio would soon be built in Allen, along with a new fine arts auditorium and career tech center. And there was another phrase that I heard again and again as I talked to people in Allen.
Allen is very different. It is a one of a kind in our state.
That's Anthony Gibson. He was the director of fine arts for the school district. And I think he was trying to assure me that I didn't need to worry about $60 million high school football stadiums becoming a thing in Texas. Allen was different. It was one of a kind. Except it wasn't. Recently, construction has begun on a $62 million stadium in Katy, Texas, outside of Houston. And then came last week's vote in McKinney. But these projects had something Allen lacked. Controversy. Not over whether the parking lot was big enough or whether traffic patterns had been properly considered. Actual controversy over whether the projects should go ahead. And the controversy suggests that maybe Allen is different after all.
They live and die football in Allen, and God bless them. That's what they want. That's great.
That's Curtis Rath. He lives in McKinney. He's a community activist and a blogger. Last May, he ran for a spot on the McKinney Independent School Board and lost. He's also run for city council and lost. Curtis loves high school football. His two children graduated from McKinney High School. And when the town spent $10 million to renovate their current stadium about a decade ago, Curtis went along. Like a lot of people in town, he didn't know about plans for a new stadium until a big blue and white sign went up on an empty lot. It said, "Future site of McKinney ISD Stadium." That sign is only 3 miles, as the crow flies, from the $60 million stadium in Allen, Texas.
Yeah, it's only like a mile from my house, so I'd driven by it. Didn't pay much attention to it. until, you know, people start talking about it on Facebook and what's this all going about. And I'm like, oh, I'll find out.
Some people might just ask, hey, what's up with that sign? Not Curtis. He filed a Freedom of Information Act request and published everything he found on his blog. Curtis seems like one of those people who stand up at every school board meeting and every city council meeting and question at least one thing in the proposed budget. Like this one time a couple of years ago.
They decided that they needed to buy laptop computers for all incoming freshmen. They decided at that time to buy top-of-the-line MacBook Air laptops. My question was, why spend $1,000 when a Chromebook would serve the purpose? But I ran into this notion that we need to do the best for our kids.
It's not that Curtis doesn't want nice things for the kids of McKinney. He and some of the other people I talked to just question whether they actually need to be the most expensive.
If somebody shows you a Chevy Nova and a Ferrari, you're going to pick the Ferrari. I mean, you're going to pick the nicest thing. Of course, it's just natural human tendency to pick the nicest, most shiny thing.
But those who support the new stadium say it won't be extravagant. It's bigger than what's needed now, but district enrollment is expected to grow in the coming decades. They point out that the building will be multi-use and it'll include conference rooms and facilities that can be rented out. And while they admit that the nearly $63 million price tag makes it seem like they're building the most expensive high school football stadium in the country, they say they're just being more transparent than other school districts have been. They're including infrastructure and site preparation costs in their budget. Construction of the stadium, they say, will cost just $50 million. All of these issues were hotly debated in McKinney, and last week the voters decided, by a two-thirds majority, that the stadium should be built. But another issue came up, one that, according to Curtis Rath, doesn't seem to have affected the outcome of the vote.
A lot of people talked about the brutality of football and concussions and predicting to me that in 10 years that football is not going to be allowed to be played at a high school level. We didn't play up that aspect of it because, you know, I am a football fan. I like to see football. I wanted to see a stadium. It was just the cost and the extravagance of the stadium that bothered me.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
It was 2013, and this pro quarterback bought a car, which wouldn't be much of a story, except he was making NFL money when he bought it, and the car was 17 years old.
It's my baby, 1996 green Ford Bronco.
The quarterback is Matt Flynn, and it would be no exaggeration to say you'd not seen nothing like the mighty Flynn as long as you were referring only to the game in 2012 in which the Green Bay Packers beat the Detroit Lions 45-41. Flynn, starting for the Packers, threw for 480 yards and 6 touchdowns that day. Bart Starr never did that. Neither did Brett Favre or Aaron Rodgers. Flynn has started a total of 6 other games in a career that has included employment, sometimes very brief employment, by 7 NFL teams.
I'm trying to hit all 32 teams before I call it quits.
A worthy goal, as long as he continues to remain on the bench, where injuries are minimal. Anyway, Matt Flynn bought the Bronco from his brother-in-law.
It was a hell of a ride.
I'm sure it was.
It was kind of my take the top off or take the back off and ride around in the country. With the wind in my hair. That was a go-to car when we needed to give the dogs a lift. It's one of those cars that added a little bit more character when it has some slobber stains, some dog hair in it.
He was going to soup up the Bronco, but travel from the bench in Oakland to the bench in New Orleans and so on got in the way, so eventually Matt decided to sell the car, which is not to say he needed the money. Matt Flynn has been paid about $19 million to play quarterback over the past 8 years. That works out to about $2,700,000 per start, which puts his per-game rate way ahead of Ben Roethlisberger, Russell Wilson, and everybody else as well. Still, when Matt's parents saw the Bronco listed on Twitter, they didn't know what to think.
They just asked me if it was the gas money that I needed, and they could help me out with it. then laughed and said, about time you get rid of that car.
A buyer willing to consider Matt's asking price, $7,000, surfaced in Houston, and the deal was done, though not without some regret.
There's a decent amount of seller's remorse going on. I look at the parking spot it was parked in front of my house, and it's just empty now.
Sounds like a country music song, doesn't it? I look out of my door each day, and it just seems to me there's nothing there but empty where my Bronco used to be. Anyway, Matt's not wasting time lamenting the Broncos' departure, though he's no longer under contract to the Packers, the Saints, the Raiders, or any of his other former employers in the NFL. It's okay with him if the phone rings. Maybe he'll even be home.
Yeah, I'm not retired. I consider myself a self-employed NFL quarterback. Mm-hmm. So I'm just here in Louisiana, staying in shape and just living life.
I would think it would be great to be a self-employed NFL quarterback as long as you live near some self-employed NFL ends and perhaps a couple of self-employed NFL offensive linemen.
That's exactly right. The salary cap's not as strict here.
And should self-employment as a quarterback not work out, Matt Flynn, having sold his Bronco on Twitter, has another option, he thinks.
I have friends now that are calling me because they have like an old refrigerator they want me to sell on Twitter for them or something. So I might just start a Twitter store and just take commission.
And so concludes the story of the quarterback who bought a car, because he sold it, so that's that. Except that he also beat the system by making $19 million for starting 7 games, and he fell into another career altogether, or at least thought about it, on a day when he told me it was 90 degrees on the porch down in Louisiana. Thought about it. Since it being May, there's no reason for even a self-employed quarterback to be thinking about football. Thanks for listening to the Only a Game podcast. If you like what you hear, please leave your comments on iTunes and rate us. Let the podcast world know we're out there. This is Only a Game. It's the University of Michigan Marching Band here to welcome two Wolverine alums who also happen to be our guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know, John Neo of the Detroit News and Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. John and Rachel, welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Bill.
I didn't know this segment was going to double as a college reunion. It's a first. It's kind of fun. I hope you enjoy reuning. All right, John, I guess it's only appropriate that we have a story this week concerning Michigan football coach Jim Harbaugh. You ready with that?
Summer's right around the corner, and I guess there's a new game for the family to play on vacation. That's Where in the World is Jim Harbaugh? He's, you get your bingo cards and destinations for all the satellite camps, Alabama, Australia, American Samoa, and you're all set. No, I mean, last summer, it was his first year back at his alma mater. He took his staff on a sort of barnstorming tour and across the country and doubled as a recruiting tool, these camps for high school kids that they put on, but they dared to do it in the South, which riled the men who coached down there, and so they complained and got the cabal of conference commissioners to get the practice banned here in early April, and then the uproar from everyone else, because, I mean, these camps do serve a purpose for families searching for college scholarships, got the ban overturned a few weeks later, and now Harbaugh's gone all Phileas Fogg on everyone with a I think it's up to 30-some stops now, 16 states, including Hawaii and Australia and Samoa. And so I guess the question for you, Rachel and Bill, is there a problem here? Is this just another sort of tax-exempt sitcom?
I'm really for an era of permissiveness, really. I think the MCA rulebook is way too big. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a Michigan grad. I do, however, think that Jim Harbaugh is just fantastic theater. He is probably the second best reality show going we have in this country right now. The issue is the contrast between what coaches are allowed to do, what players are allowed to do, and a lot of players are increasingly pushing back at the limits to what they can earn, and that's only going to get worse as coaches and conference commissioners get paid more and more. So I think those guys, the leaders, need to be careful about what they ban and how strict they are with players.
What's occurring to me is that there is no longer any distinction at all between pro football as it's practiced in the NFL and pro football as it's played at places like Michigan.
There is one difference, and Rachel just hit on it. The players are not getting paid.
We're looking forward to that changing, right? I mean, the door is open a crack, at least, on that.
The pressure is mounting, and Michigan spent 200-some thousand on their summer swarm tour, as they called it last summer. Mm-hmm. That money is there, and the players are not seeing it. The coaches and everyone else are.
Absolutely. Rachel, I understand you have something to say about pesky millennials.
I do. This might not be popular with some of our listeners, but news breaking last week, the American running boom is over. The number of race finishers in the U.S. declined 9%, which halted about a two-decade, seems like, inevitable rise of runners. And the reason is millennials. The millennials were the biggest reduction in those race finishers. And the jury's sort of out on why this happened. One theory is that there are more and more other things to do to keep yourself in shape, anything from CrossFit to yoga. Another theory floated is that millennials just simply are not as competitive as older generations and didn't really like entering races. Mm. So let the debate ensue.
I wonder if maybe some millennials are getting old enough so that their knees hurt.
That could be. Some people have cited the movement away from long distance because they say that's stupid. You're gonna ruin your joints, and we're doing smarter things with our bodies.
This whole idea of at least the possibility of millennials being less competitive for whatever combination of reasons that might be, what does that mean for sports going forward?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we ran a story that showed that there are many fewer millennial entrepreneurs. And the reason cited was that millennials are more risk-averse.
I wonder, too, and I don't necessarily subscribe to this, but all the talk of the participation trophies and that sort of, you know, everybody gets a ribbon for participating. I wonder if that has seeped through even into the competitive spirit of a generation. I don't know. I doubt it. But I'm sure that's an argument some people would make.
Certainly a lot of our readers chimed in with to that effect that, you know, this is the problem with giving everyone a trophy. Everyone thinks they've won.
Nobody knows who's going to be president of Brazil this summer, but Rio is going to host the Olympic Games anyway, maybe. Maybe the International Olympic Committee is going to take seriously the warning published this week in the Harvard Public Health Review, which says if they have the Olympics, it will accelerate at least somewhat the spread of the Zika virus throughout the world. Russia, meanwhile, another story coming up about doping, a systematic state-run doping program in Russia. Kenya apparently is okay. They're going to let the Kenyans participate in the Olympics in Rio, though there was considerable dismay about their failure to have a decent, reasonable doping program. The bribery and the doping stories feel to me like business as usual. They're sad, but the Zika thing, more dire, I think. Is it time to call Rio and say, hey, look, sorry, this isn't going to work out. We're going to start a new precedent. We're going to spread the Olympic events around, say, half a dozen countries. Nobody goes broke. Everybody gets a chance to be on TV. And that's the way we'll do it from here on in. What do you think?
The biggest pushback you might get from this, surprisingly, might be NBC, which surely has invested tons of time and money in the heavy production value they surely will put into these games. I think that the split would be really untenable, especially at this late time. I think we're only 3 months out. But I'm not sure what else you do. I think this underscores the need from the IOC for a contingency plan.
You know, the worry about the disease spreading from all the visitors coming, I think that will be solved by not very many visitors coming. And we saw this before in Athens and Beijing with, you know, a variety of reasons. Athens, where there was terror fears. That was the first real summer games after 9/11. And in China with all the pollution and human rights issues. So I would guess we're going to have a lot of half-empty venues in Rio, which doesn't do much for their economy that's already in a recession.
I mean, I know that before every Olympic Games, there are dire predictions about how the venues aren't ready and the country isn't really as economically strong as it was years before when they made the bid and all the rest of that stuff always happens. This just seems to me as if the negatives are stronger, more powerful, more daunting than normal. Am I wrong? Am I being too much of a pessimist?
No, absolutely not. And they're getting worse rather than sort of fading as the games approach. I mean, the coup d'etat of sorts that has just taken place there, that's not going to be over by August. I mean, they've got, I think, 180 days to make a decision here. But, you know, that's going to be still an ongoing political issue.
Well, I wish as the Olympics approach that we'd been able to conclude this discussion on a happier note. But we don't really seem to be able to do that right now.
The weather's nice here.
Yeah, the weather's very nice in Boston this week as well. But the citizens of Boston said, no, we don't wish to have the Olympics. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and that gets to the point. I mean, you talk about moving. Who wants them? Who would take them at this point, frankly?
My guests for three stories you should know have been John Neo of the Detroit News and Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for making us feel welcome.
And I think I'm supposed to say go blue now, right? I got that right?
That is right.
That's how
okay.
you say it.
Go blue. During the 1950s, a teenage girl from Toronto swam her way to celebrity multiple times. Marilyn Bell set world records for marathon swimming. She appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show, and she was the inspiration for a children's doll, the ads for which called her the darling of a nation. Years later, circumstances combined to deprive her, forever, she thought, of the activity that had made her famous, the activity she loved. Marilyn Bell tells her story in her own words.
I remember so clearly the first sensation of floating, you know, when you finally feel your legs come up, your head is in the water, you're relaxed. I was 9 years old when I had my first swimming lesson, and that was the beginning. Sometimes I would finish third, most often I would finish fourth. I had very few gold medals in my medal box when I finally discovered longer distance swimming. In July of 1954, there was a 26-mile race around the island where Atlantic City is located. And I was only 16, and there were 39 participants. I think about 12 of them were women. I actually placed, I think I was seventh in the race, so I beat a lot of men, which was really exciting. Oh my goodness, I've never forgotten that experience. That's when my coach got the idea that if I could swim 26 miles in salt water, that there was a good chance that I could swim 32 miles in fresh water. The Canadian National Exhibition was kind of on a par with, a World's Fair. They weren't really drawing crowds, and they invited Florence Chadwick to attempt to swim across Lake Ontario, because, of course, it had never been done. Florence Chadwick was world-renowned. She swam the English Channel, I think, two times before I actually met her. Everybody was really ticked off that one person was going to have a chance to win. It was a $10,000 prize if she made it. My swim coach, he got one of the newspapers to agree if he could come up with a swimmer, they would agree to pay the expenses for that swimmer. And he had a couple of people in mind. One was a gentleman that I swam with, but I guess the newspaper didn't think that, you know, a man swimming against a woman, it wouldn't be fair. So as a result, I think by default, Marilyn Bell was chosen to be the challenger. Of course, when she dove in, there was plenty of light because the television crews were there and her boat had spotlights and floodlights. So she was well lit as she dove into the water. I dove in about 15 minutes later, and by then there were one or two photographers left, and my boat was not there. My boat was about a quarter mile to a half mile offshore. So I swam for about a half hour in the darkness on my own, petrified, absolutely petrified. You never swim alone, and you certainly never swim alone at night if you have any sense at all. And even to this day, I think, was I crazy? My goal was not to swim all the way across Lake Ontario. I didn't think that Florence Chadwick could do it. I really didn't think that I could do it either, but my goal was to swim further than she did. When Florence was pulled out of the water, she got very, very sick, and it was rough, and she, you know, she really suffered. My coach never told me, because by then I was swimming very smoothly. I'd found my groove. Dawn was breaking. It was the most beautiful sunrise I ever experienced. Later in the day, when I was getting very, very tired and I had decided I'd had enough and I wanted out, then my coach, Gus Ryder, said, "Well, you're the only one left in here because Florence got out hours ago, so it's really up to you to do it." When I actually touched the break wall in Toronto, there's a photograph taken of it. When I saw that photograph for the first time, I thought, wow, I don't even remember that. There were thousands of people on the lake shore making all kinds of noise. I guess I was just so worn out that I didn't know I had finished, and I kept swimming away from people that were trying to grab me. So it wasn't until, oh, I don't know, maybe 40 minutes later, when they had me in an ambulance, finally I said, "So what finally happened?" I had no idea. I had no idea what would follow. After Lake Ontario, I became an instant celebrity, I guess the word would be. I remember going back to school and one of my teachers saying to me, "Well, you know, it's not very ladylike to be walking around in a bathing suit, but I guess it's okay." The following year, I swam the English Channel, and I was the youngest to swim the English Channel at that time. I was 17. And then in 1956, I swam the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and I was the first Canadian woman to do that. I think I'm the only one in the history of the city of Toronto to have had three ticker tape parades in succession. The private Marilyn Bell disappeared for a time. I became this public person. I was just being torn apart. So after the last swim, the Strait of Juan de Fuca, I decided, I'm done with this. I lost my joy for swimming. And the other piece of that is I fell in love. When I was 16, I met a lifeguard at the Atlantic City Swim, and we had corresponded for 3 years. And then we decided that we wanted to really spend our lives together. So by the time I swam Juan de Fuca, I knew that as soon as my lifeguard had graduated from college, that we would get married. And I knew that I could not be a swimmer, a celebrity, and a wife. I wasn't wired to do all of those things and do them well. So the easiest thing was to give up being a swimmer and giving up the celebrity piece and becoming Marilyn D'Alassio. And after my children were born, you know, I taught them to swim, and then we would go to the pool together, and I swam, and I could swim a couple of miles in the pool, but I developed scoliosis. It was a late onset of scoliosis, which has created a lot of deterioration in my spine. I finally had to say, okay, I can't do this anymore. It's just too painful. It's not helping me. So I totally stopped until 2 years ago. A friend has another friend. His name is Terry Lachlan. And he said, "If you're willing to change your stroke, you'll be back swimming without pain." And I thought, yeah, right. That wonderful feeling I had as a kid when I was 9. Well, that happened when Terry was working with me the first day. He had me float. When I came out of the water, I looked at him. I said, "Oh my gosh, I haven't felt this since I was 9 years old. This is wonderful." Within probably, I'm going to say 3 months, I was swimming 2 hours in our little pool without pain. Before my 80th birthday, I'm hoping that I'll get to swim maybe 10 or 13 miles in the Hudson River. I have that in my bucket list. I love to swim now. I get up every morning at 5:30 to swim. It's just like the best part of my day.
The 1956 record Marilyn Bell D'Alessio set Swimming the Strait of Juan de Fuca between Victoria, British Columbia, and Port Angeles, Washington still stands today. She currently lives in New York, and she swims every day. Our story was produced by Bob Schaefer. Check out Only a Game next week. We'll hear the story of the first wounded veteran of World War II to return to organized baseball. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of the most infamous chair in basketball history. Hint, it was mobile for a time. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Tuesday, Steph Curry was named the NBA's most valuable player for the second consecutive year, and the vote was not close. In fact, it was unanimous. First time that that's happened. Did Michael Jordan just have better competition when he was winning five MVPs?
Well, I think people abandoned the lunatic notion, which also happens, by the way, in the Baseball Hall of Fame, that if you haven't made anybody a unanimous choice yet, you can't ever make anybody one. You know, yeah, Babe Ruth wasn't a unanimous choice, so why shouldn't, you name the player after him? And apparently the people who vote for the NBA MVP award are more evolved than that.
Shortly after that MVP announcement, LeBron James, who's won the award four times, opined that the V in MVP is open to interpretation. He also said Steph Curry deserved the award. And then did he say, just saying?
Yeah, well, as we mentioned before, Bill, there are three sports arguments that I refuse to have. The first is who should win the Heisman Trophy. Second is who should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And third and final is what does the V in Most Valuable Player stand for? Because these are pointless arguments that have no end. But I will tell you the honest truth. If I had a vote this year, it would have gone to LeBron James.
Steph Curry's Warriors will play Oklahoma City in the Western Conference Finals. Do we like that matchup?
Yeah, I mean, that's the matchup everybody's waiting to see. The Thunder seem to have risen to the occasion finally, and the San Antonio Spurs, alas for their magnificent run, looked really old in the last two games.
The NHL has reached its penultimate playoff round of the Stanley Cup Finals. It's Pittsburgh and Tampa Bay in the East, St. Louis and San Jose in the West. The Sharks have been infamous in recent years for their collapses during the playoffs. Do they break form this year and maybe hoist the cup?
Well, it's possible. I mean, they were taken to Game 7 by the Nashville Predators, but they came out and just blew the Predators away. They won the Game 7 5-0. So it's entirely possible that they're over that particular obstacle.
I know that you are a big Alex Ovechkin fan. His Washington Capitals were the best team during the NHL regular season and were early postseason favorites, but they were ushered out of the playoffs in the second round. Do they bounce back?
I have no idea. I can't figure this team out in the playoffs at all. Ovechkin, whose abilities I adore, gets taken out of his game much too easily in the postseason. He's got to find a way not to do that.
Let us turn to baseball, and I ask, would I be jinxing the Cubs if I mentioned that they are playing as well as any team has ever played in mid-May?
No, I watched them all last weekend, and let me tell you, that is a really good baseball team. It's a great mix of the right kind of free agents and young players who have come up through the system, and I think we've said this before, if Theo Epstein, having already gotten the Red Sox their first World Championship since 1918, manages to pull this off, I think he walks to Cooperstown in style.
Max Scherzer of the Washington Nationals struck out 20 Detroit Tigers on Wednesday night, thus tying the record for K's in a 9-inning Major League game. Kerry Wood and Roger Clemens share that record. Is Scherzer afraid of success? Couldn't he have struck out one more guy?
I don't understand why that seems to be the 4-minute mile of pitchers. They can't get that 21st strikeout.
Mets pitcher Bartolo Colon got a lot of attention this week for hitting a home run last weekend. Big deal. Home run. People hit him all the time.
Colon had never hit one. Plus, he looks like your uncle who drives a bus. And they were so impressed by it. The folks at Topps put the moment of his – actually, it's not the moment he hit the ball. It's the moment he's following through on a baseball card, and it sold better than any baseball card ever has ever.
60% of the PGA Tour pros have said that they would rather win the Players' Championship than an Olympic gold medal. Does this tarnish the return of golf to the games for the first time since 1904?
No. Golf should not be returning to the games, and I congratulate the PGA golfers for being honest about it.
Tom Brady said this week, and I'm quoting, "Concussions are just part of life." I wonder if this suggests that maybe pro football players are not quite as thoroughly educated about the dangers associated with their profession as Roger Goodell has been saying they are.
Well, not just that, but it's a further indication that Tom Brady is going to go through his entire career trying desperately not to say anything that alienates anybody. He knows this is wrong. He knows that it's not part of life. Getting 2 and 3 and 5 and 10 and 11 concussions is not part of any life except a life in which you are playing football.
The University of Nebraska football program is in the news this week. The university is being sued for its tradition of releasing balloons after the team's first touchdown. The claim is that the balloons are a hazard to children and to wildlife when they inevitably fall back to Earth. Does this fly in court or just a lot of hot air?
Oh, boy. Somebody else said it besides me. Excellent. I have no idea. I mean, I'm sure there are some environmental concerns about dead balloons falling everywhere, but I can't believe that there's so many balloons get released that they're that much of an environmental damage. It all depends, I suppose, if the judge wants to go on vacation early or not.
And finally, Charlie, a man fishing in Loreto.
Sports!
Yeah, what? Fishing. It's a sport fishing. Loreto, okay. Mexico.
Yeah.
Anyway, this guy landed a world record yellowfin tuna, except that it wasn't. Why not?
So he had filleted his record-breaking fish prior to reporting it, which apparently, under the rules of sport fishing, disqualifies it. But he will eat for years.
Can't you see the guy on the boat when they're telling him the rules and he's trying to put the fish back together and say, no, look, it's okay. Look, you know, just okay. Look, this is what it looked like.
I mean, he's got a picture. I mean, it's a big fish, yeah. I'll tell you. It has to be weighed on a scale that's certified by the International Game Fish Association and by a registered representative. But unfortunately, this guy caught this tuna way out in a very remote place. He didn't have access for a scale, so he chopped it up before he made the call.
Yeah.
And it's really too bad. I hope he enjoys eating it, because I'll tell you what, that is good-looking fish.
His name is Robert, which is kind of a shame, where we could say, sorry, Charlie.
I have lived with that joke, ladies and gentlemen, for almost 50 years of my life. This is how you know Bill and I get along.
He didn't hit me.
Because I didn't come right over the table and rip out his eyeballs.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at SI.com, and he joins me each week on Only a Game. Hope he'll come back next week.
I'll be here.
Okay, thanks, Charlie. According to commentator Mike Pesca, these are the best of sports times and the worst of sports times, and he prefers the latter.
This year is the Annus Mirabilis of basketball and baseball. The Golden State Warriors set a record for wins in a season. They are so good that they make playoff series that end 4-1 seem compelling. You know, the Golden State Warriors made 1,077 three-pointers as a team. In 1980-81, the second year the three-point shot was a thing in the NBA, the entire league combined to make 943 three-pointers. What I'm saying is the Golden State Warriors are good. Steph Curry is good. He made over 400 three-point shots this year. It took 15 years before a single team combined to make 400 three-point shots. And in baseball, the Cubs are so good that at this pace, they will win more games than any other team in history. They've scored about 200 runs. They've given up about 100 runs. That's a 2-1 ratio. Take the 1927 Yankees, fairly good team. They'd have to score 200 more runs than they did to get to that ratio. But as much as it is a miracle year for greatness, it's also something of an annus horribilis, like the 10-win Philadelphia 76ers. Actually, it might not even be horribilis, certainly not mirabilis. It's probably just annus. And the thing is, I love the terrible teams. I love the hapless. I love the desperate. I find them every bit as compelling as the great teams. Not pleasing to watch, but fascinating to ponder. So remember those stats, the fun facts I threw at you about the Warriors in the beginning? Those are nice to know. Maybe they flesh out how good the teams are, but really, it's the wins and losses that tell the story. The greatness of those teams is apparent, like a painting by Monet. But with terrible teams, like the 76ers or the Atlanta Braves, they're like a work by Francis Bacon, or better yet, Hieronymus Bosch, grotesqueries, but with fascinating texture. Take the Atlanta Braves. Every other team in the NL has. The Atlanta Braves, heading into this weekend's games, had 9 combined home runs. There are 16 individual players with as many home runs. One of these men is Jose Altuve, who is the smallest player in Major League Baseball. If the entire Braves 25-man roster were laid end-to-end, it would equal 28 Jose Altuves and be out-homered by them all. In the middle of this week, I saw this stat. Every team that has played at Turner Field this season has won at least 2 games except the Atlanta Braves. Now, some context. The Atlanta Braves' home stadium is Turner Field. Now, they beat the Phillies on Wednesday to push their home record to 2-17. So congrats, Braves. You're now tied for last in Turner Field wins. To me, these facts are more fun and more illuminating than the equivalent stats about the good teams. There is a fascinating texture to failure that compels, that illuminates, that illustrates the badness. It's why we're thrilled by Bartolo Colon hitting a home run, because he's so bad at home runs, and why the ineptitude of the Faroe Islands soccer team and certain English ski jumpers stay with us. Winning is heroism, and heroes by definition are not like us, and the terrible failures, they're not really tragic, they're comic, and I find them more relatable and in a way more hopeful than a barrage of 3-pointers I could never make or a spate of home runs I could never hit. Also, tickets to their home games are a lot cheaper.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast The Gist from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday. I'm told that there's a whole television show dedicated to finding various lost and significant sports-related items, like Muhammad Ali's 1960 Olympic gold medal, Kirk Gibson's 1988 World Series home run ball, and Dale Earnhardt's original bright pink race car. But long before they made a TV show about such adventures, Greg Doyle set out to find a notorious, long-lost sports relic. He wrote a column about the search.
It's behind this door. That's what I've been told. It's a chair. Red molded plastic on sheet metal legs, and it wouldn't fetch $2 at a garage sale unless it was this chair. The chair. The one Bob Knight threw across the court in 1985 against Purdue. The chair is stored deep inside Assembly Hall, and I'm thinking, this chair, the chair, deserves better. Better than this. An anonymous door, black metal, unmarked and unremarkable. Treasure, buried in an unmarked grave.
This is it,
Indiana University Facilities Director Chuck Crabb says as he pushes open the door. It's warm in here, musty. Just concrete floor and cinder blocks for walls and 8 light bulbs hanging from the ceiling. 7 lights work.
This is a machine room, he says. A switchgear room.
This is an unworthy room, because that's the most famous chair in college basketball history. It was February 23rd, 1985. Indiana was 14-9 and heading for the NIT, and the referees were not having a great day.
And a jump situation. Now, wait a minute, foul called.
5 minutes into the game, Steve Alford dove for a loose ball, tied up a Purdue player, and was called for a foul.
Pretty obvious what call he wanted.
Seconds later, Darryl Thomas was called for a ticky-tack foul in the post.
And the 6th Indiana team foul. We've only played 5 minutes of the first half.
Bob Knight was yelling at referee Fred Jaspers, who came over to warn him. Knight sat down, muttering, and Jaspers heard him.
Fred Jaspers now chasing Bobby Knight back to his chair.
And
he's
we
got
a technical.
Right there. There's the tee.
Bedlam at Assembly Hall.
Look at here. Bobby Knight just threw his chair clear across the free throw lane.
Knight was ejected. Tee. He walked out to the thunderous sound of Bobby. Reed was given 6 technical free throws, but the Thunder undid the Big Ten's leading foul shooter. He missed 3 of 6. What happened next to the chair? Lots of people think they know. Lots of people are wrong.
Stories about the chair are many, Crabb is telling me as we stare at the chair inside that warm, dingy machine room. Or maybe we're not looking at the chair. The chair could be in that stack.
it could be gone. Nobody knows. Not even the guy who paid $8,000 for it in 2003 while visiting the Nevada governor's mansion. A handful of people think they really have it. So many people over the years have mentioned it to me on emails or on Facebook. I have the chair. Do you? Really? Here's what Crab knows about the chair, and this is all he knows. After the chair went across the court, the manager picked it up and took it away. Later that day, the chairs were set on a rack and wheeled away. Wait, so you're telling me the chair, sorry, the chair is unaccounted for? It's like the ending to Indiana Jones. The Ark of the Covenant is in one of those crates in a giant warehouse. But which crate? Nobody knows. How many people have come looking for the chair? You're the first. When Assembly Hall opened in 1971, IU ordered 100 red molded plastic chairs to serve as team benches and to fill the gaps next to the bleachers. People, maybe workers, bring friends into the building and they find themselves here in this room. Hey, what do you know? There's the chairs. And one goes missing. You're saying there are just 16 chairs left? 16 out of 100 because some broke and the rest were stolen? Not stolen, Krebs says, smiling. Procured. If this is how it ends, it's a sad finish for such a famous chair. Cable and electrical wires cover the walls like kudzu. A steel ladder is on the floor. Well, that's a lot of juice you're looking at there, Crab says. And I suppose he's looking at the electrical switches. I'm looking at 16 red molded plastic chairs. I'm looking for scratches. Any sign that this is the chair that skidded across Assembly Hall and into college basketball legend? I'm looking for greatness, for history. But I'm seeing red molded plastic chairs. The kind you'd buy for $2 at a garage sale and wonder if you were ripped off.
That's Walter Dixon reading a column written by Greg Doyle for the Indianapolis Star. You can link to the original piece called Quest for a Legendary Relic, Bob Knight's Chair, at onlyagame.org. This was the first in a new feature we're trying out that celebrates great sports writing of the short form variety. We're thinking of calling it Radio Playbook, or maybe Column Like You See 'Em. Have a better name in mind? Please let us know. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Walter Dixon, Bob Schaefer, and Mary Wilson. Our senior producer is Gary Wallen. Our final word comes from football player and car salesman Matt Flynn. I suggested that he consider donating his next vehicle to a public radio station rather than selling it.
I'll keep it in mind. Just let's stay in touch.
You got it, Matt. What are you driving now? Maserati? DeLorean? Maybe a Lamborghini? I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style and Only a Game. Thanks for listening.